You're listening to The Read Out, one development leader, their big idea, and how it can shape the future of Australian development assistance. Hosted by Lab CEO, Bridie Rice.
Today, we're going to do something a little different. I'm going to take you behind the scenes of some of the work that the Lab does to generate good-natured debate and better understanding of development here in Canberra. Now, this isn't analysis you'll find on our website. So let me give you a quick little bit of background before bringing in our guest, Dr. Michael Green. In December last year, the Lab hosted a debate here in Canberra between the Australian National University's Darren Lim, host of the podcast Australia in the World, and the US Studies Centre's Mike Green. Now, the topic was, the main game for Australian development is development, not building influence. Now, Mike was arguing for the affirmative and Darren argued it out for the negative. And this proposition seemed simple for the audience at first. Now, of course, for some, Australian development dollars should be spent on building Australian influence in the region, particularly with the governments of countries in Southeast Asia and the Pacific. For these people, generating influence is the DNA of international relations and foreign policy. But scratch the surface a little deeper and you also find some examples of a fine line between the aid budget being used by Australia to generate development, think people educated, fair elections and inclusive economies, and what Australia's Minister for International Development, Pat Conroy, has described in a speech as transactionalism. Now, my words, not his, but he's nodding to the risk that aid dollars are spent to keep Australia's elite government partners on side, and sometimes this comes at the cost of a development result for people in the region. And that's really what this debate is about. Sounds complex, huh? Well, this debate does my head in, but it is a big one here in Canberra and around the world. So as we prepared for the debate, Mike, Darren and I got together a few times. Now, neither of them are development experts. Darren, of course, is a geopolitical analyst, and Mike is a world-class security thinker. The last few books of his all had the words grand strategy in their title, if that gives you any indication. But what struck me most as we prepared was how matter-of-fact my colleague Mike was on development, and in particular, the importance of Australia being courageous in our development assistance on things like gender equality, inequality, and democracy. Now, we ran this debate under Chatham House rules, so it is not published, but I have the next best thing for you. Mike joins me today to go another round. Mike, great to have you on The Readout.
Thank you. Enjoyed the debate and looking forward to this.
Well, Mike, at the debate, we had almost 200 people in the room and online, and you were brave enough to accept my challenge to argue until you were blue in the face that Australia has lost its way, we've embroiled our aid program in our influence agenda, and the only way back is to refocus our development assistance on generating shock, horror, development outcomes. Can you talk our listeners through the main arguments you made on the day?
Sure. And of course, Darren and I were assigned these positions. And what's so interesting about a kind of Oxford rules debate, where you take a somewhat artificial binary choice and argue the pros for your side, what's so useful is it really makes you think about the trade-offs and the tensions. And as you said, I read a lot of books about strategy, but strategy and grand strategy, national level strategy, is ultimately about reconciling two mutually exclusive objectives you have, like national security and improving the lives of people in Southeast Asia and the Pacific. And they don't have to be at odds, but as you noted in your introduction, there are hard trade-offs. So when this debate was a really great way to spotlight what those trade-offs are. And then, of course, you and Darren and I had a good discussion afterwards about how we would actually integrate the two positions we took. But that said, I'm probably 60 or 70% on side with the position you assigned me, that development strategy should be about development. I have some experience in development. I'm on the board of the Asia Foundation, which does work with DFAT and USAID and state. And I've had policy positions in the past where I had some oversight of development, but I'm not a development professional. I took a look at this largely from a strategic lens. And development as development has three really important advantages that transactionalism doesn't. The first is the long-term strategic effects. Transactionalism is a kind of whack-a-mole where you are prioritizing access and influence, which is very short-term, ultimately. But if you have a development policy that focuses on women's empowerment, good governance, civil society strengthening, accountability, ultimately. You help these societies become much more resilient against foreign interference, which in the long run is strategically a much more significant strategic effect. And you build constituencies and communities that in the long run are going to be favorable to Australia, even if the leader in power in the short run is not. And a purely transactional approach loses that long-term strategic effect. And frankly, is not something that a democracy is going to play as well as, say, China. And the second reason why development as development matters is because it aligns Australia with the other large development countries in the OECD Donor Assistance Committee, the DAC, and allows Australia to shape the priorities, the agenda, based on norms that are largely accepted by other major donors like Japan or the United States or Korea, which is increasing its funding. And it would be much more effective for Australia to leverage its donor contribution, its aid dollars, vis-a-vis other donors like Japan or Korea or the US or Europe, if we're all singing from the same hymnal, if we're all following the DAC rules on what constitutes good development outcomes and good development practices. If you go it alone in a transactional case-by-case influence game, you separate yourself from the other major players and you lose strategic influence in the end. And then the third reason is, you know, as a democracy, Australia's development assistance depends on domestic support. And there will be some Australian voters who say, absolutely, use my tax money to get influence. But there will be many, many Australians who care about women's empowerment, who care about a free press. And you risk a backlash against sustainable development. So those are three very, very strong reasons from a strategic perspective and a national security perspective that you want good development outcomes to be the objective of your development. But you have to be transactional sometimes. We're in a knife fight for influence in some parts of the world. And you ultimately, or any government, has got to decide how to prioritize and how to make these trade-offs. But I would lean more towards staying faithful to the development priorities that we've had rather than suddenly adopting a transactional approach.
So your answer to the question of just how transactional should we be is about a 70-30 ratio. I like it. Well, Mike, let's go another round on that. You're certainly no stranger to Talking Hawk, and you've just named what's going on in the region as a knife fight for influence. Now, our listeners are more than familiar with how development assistance can be used for an incredible sustainable development outcome, but also how it can be used for a variety of other outcomes, be it China's Belt and Road Initiative, US re-engagement in the Pacific, you know, Australia, Japan, South Korea, Europe, you name it. They're all getting back in the development game in some way, shape or form. So you've made the case for a development focus being the primary goal of Australian development. Tell us why this is also geopolitically smart.
If you look at the way that China, in particular, uses weak governance, corruption, and poor press freedom to advance its interests in places like the Solomon Islands, or Sri Lanka, or Laos, the lack of that accountability, the lack of a strong civil society, the lack of a free press, the lack of functioning parliamentary systems, counter-corruption measures, that creates a sort of very permissive environment to just roll in and use sometimes literally bags of cash or very bad development programs like Hanbon Tota in Sri Lanka to buy short-term influence. So a program that focuses on good development outcomes on the economic side, and then on the civil society side, does two things for you in a situation like that. On the civil society side, it helps build those members of the community who will hold government accountable and who will shine a light on corruption and who will push for better governance, will push for in development projects, women's empowerment, local community engagement, things, you know, China tends not to do with BRI. So you create a resilience that makes it harder to do elite capture and harder to push for bad development outcomes that are transactional on China's side. But the second thing I think it does is, particularly if you're also offering economic development assistance, infrastructure financing, and so forth, it gives alternatives. And that combination is really important. The civil society, women's empowerment, governance, democracy bit alone is not enough. There has to be an alternative. And this is why the alignment with other donors is so important. Because Japan is actually, people debate the numbers, but Japan is basically the largest provider of infrastructure financing in the Indo-Pacific, not China. And so Australia doesn't have to do everything. If Australia targets its aid to get good development outcomes, more accountable civil societies, that reinforces efforts that Japan or the US, Japan, and Australia make to provide infrastructure financing that is what the Japanese call quality infrastructure, where it is sustainable, where it includes women and community engagement, where it has transparency and accountability. And ultimately, this is not just, in my view, about better development outcomes in these countries or about more resilient societies that can resist elite capture. Ultimately, it's geostrategic because if these recipient countries for BRI are able to stand up for themselves, are demanding higher quality aid, have alternatives, I think this is going to have, over time, potentially, a positive effect on China's aid practices. It's going to create demands on China that are reasonable demands. And in some ways, you saw a microcosm of this, although not around democracy per se, but in the way that Mahathir renegotiated a major development project with China when he came in. When these countries are empowered and informed, are held accountable by their people, they're going to make China more accountable in how it does development. And I think this is one area where, over time, geopolitical competition with China can bend potentially in a better direction. If China has no pressures from countries to perform well, you know, its geopolitical interests will continue to push Beijing towards development outcomes that serve China's very either mercantilist or military or diplomatic results, even if it's not good development policy.
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly a clear-cut geostrategic case for development that we haven't seen on this development podcast before, but our listeners are going to enjoy unpicking. Just to wind back a second, though, Mike, interestingly, you are one of a number of national security thinkers who are increasingly turning their minds to the importance of Australia bolstering civil society accountability, free media, and the rest. Now, there are policymakers in this country that would also be saying, hang on, that is just too sensitive. It's too hard to work on corruption. It jeopardizes Australia's relationships to touch free press and other sensitive issues like this. What is your counterargument to those policymakers that say this is just too sensitive?
Australia does play a really important role in women's empowerment in particular. And there are many tools to get at anti-corruption, and there are international agreements on anti-corruption that Australia can leverage and find like-minded states pulling in the same direction. And it's important for development outcomes because one of the reasons that there's so little private sector investment into the Pacific, and that includes Australia, the US, and Japan, is because the private sector doesn't have confidence that they can get return on their investment because of corruption. So it's good economic development policy to focus on this. Now, the best way to do it might not be to name and blame corrupt officials in DFAT reports. Maybe that's not the best way. That might be too sensitive. But supporting training anti-corruption units, supporting training civil society and journalists in reporting on this, there are a lot of indirect ways to build up the agency or the actors within societies who will be trained and understand and have international standards and support to hold their own governments accountable. And look, to me, it's a no-brainer. If it's sensitive for governments, it's even more sensitive for the private sector. It's very hard for a Boeing or a Bechtel or a Telstra to go in and do anti-corruption. They need the government to do it. And it's in Australia's business and economic interest. So you're not going to get investment. You're not going to get good development outcomes unless you focus on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly what you're saying is very consistent with some of the analysis that we're getting out of civil society leaders across Southeast Asia, saying that issues of accountability, transparency, and good governance are actually the key enablers of economic development and other types of outcomes. Well, Mike, would you believe it? We are almost at the end of our episode. And if you were lucky enough to listen to the last season of The Readout, then you'll know that our lab hypothetical is coming. So, Mike, get your pitch on. I need you to imagine that you board an elevator. And as you board that elevator and the doors close, you find yourself sandwiched between Australia's foreign minister and our prime minister. Now, you've only got a moment, and miraculously, their advisors have all disappeared. What is the one thing you would say to them when it comes to Australian development assistance in 2024?
Be ambitious. Australia can shape larger debates about development, larger pots of money in the developing world, and ultimately how resilient and aligned countries in the Pacific Southeast Asia are if it holds itself and holds its development programs to a high standard and doesn't fall to a transactional guacamole game with China. Although, if we're not yet on the ground floor, I would add, there are going to be times when you have to drop everything I just said and take a very transactional approach. If there's a critical strategic piece of infrastructure like telecommunications or undersea cables that has direct national security implications for Australia, there will be some cases where what I said doesn't apply, but 70% of the time it should. Ding, here we are on the ground floor.
Well, Mike, thank you for this excellent conversation. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the readout. You are the epitome of someone that we like to collaborate with. You are thinking and working differently to the way that we do in the development sector. And these kinds of understanding and collaboration are absolutely critical to the future of contestability on development in our country. So, Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Brady.
Well, join me next time on The Readout, where each episode we sit down with one author, one big idea, and talk about how it can shape the future of Australia's development assistance. And if you liked hearing from Mike, then you can find links to the sorts of things that Mike and I have been discussing today in our show notes. And if you want extra previews, insights, and development analysis, then sign up to our email at devintelligencelab.com. A special thanks to the lab team behind the scenes, that's Ruby St. Ledger and Walter Kolnagy. I'm Bridie Rice. This is The Readout. Talk soon.
We at The Lab acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which this podcast is recorded, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and we extend our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We're inspired by the storytelling tradition of the world's oldest living culture, and we pay homage to it when we share our stories or intelligence on this podcast.